listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Johanna Desta's story on Kristen Stewart. From the House of Hollywood section, with photos by Maurizio Cattelan and Pierpaolo Ferrari, styled by Katie Grand. Stewart herself lives in L.A. Despite her obsessive research, Stewart didn't become an expert on the contemporary royals, and only watched snippets of the explosive Prince Harry and Meghan Markle interview with Oprah Winfrey. It was almost too hot to touch in terms of how personal it was for me at that time, she says. I ask her if it's strange to think about Harry and Meghan living in California. As improbable as it seems, Stewart was unaware of their move. That's so funny. I wonder where, she muses. Then she stops. I'm no better than anyone. Of course I want to know. Santa Barbara, I tell her. She nods approvingly. That makes sense. It's really nice up there. In November, Stewart revealed her engagement to her girlfriend of more than 2 years, screenwriter Dylan Meyer. I love being engaged, Stewart says with a smile. It's different. I just feel so happy and lucky. The duo is working on a TV show together, in which Stewart has said she will star. At first, she was a little scared to work with Meyer, worried it might go sideways. You don't want that to affect this beautiful relationship you have. They wound up writing the first episode in a week and a half. Like we discovered a superbrain, says Stewart. She's a really, genuinely brilliant effing screenwriter. While she looks ahead to future projects, she's still firmly in the present, happily reuniting with Larianne on the awards trail for Spencer. The director's confidence in her continues unabated. He just loves this movie and me so much, and the purity of that is the sweetest and coolest thing, she says. We had such a great effing time. There's no way around that. Next photos are of Benedict Cumberbatch and Idris Elba. This from Rebecca Ford. Idris Elba, with a far-reaching slate of movies ahead, including a big-screen adaptation of Luther, Idris Elba is flexing his versatility and making room for music. On a crisp December evening, Idris Elba rescued a group of men from embarrassment. The night had taken a turn for the worse for the young chaps after they were denied entry to a hot London club. But Elba happened to be walking by the venue, where he and his friends are regulars, and chatted with the manager to get the group in, even offering to buy them a table. The incident went viral on TikTok. Elba laughs, thinking about it now. This guy appealed to me because I was him, he says over a Zoom call in early January. I was definitely that guy being turned away just because I'm slightly bigger and I don't fit the criteria of the club. It's hard to imagine anyone turning away Elba, whose charismatic talent and suave demeanor have helped him become a global superstar. But a lot of work and thought have gone into getting to this point, and with the actor about to celebrate his 50th birthday in September, he seems to have reached a place where all he wants to do is keep surprising people. This refusal to stay within any one box has allowed Elba to star in nearly all of Hollywood's biggest franchises, Avengers, Fast and Furious, The Suicide Squad, while also delivering deep character work with The Wire, Beast of No Nation, and Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. Right now, he's in London shooting Netflix's first Luther movie based on the hit TV series that has earned him 4 Emmy nominations since he took on the role of the troubled detective in 2010. Making a film version in this shadowy world was always high on his bucket list, and he hopes for more. For those that like the exploration on the dark side of human beings, it's well done. It's well written, Elba says. Coming up, he'll appear in 2 movies that couldn't be more different. George Miller's fantasy feature, 3,000 Years of Longing, opposite Tilda Swinton, and Beast, a survival thriller in which he plays a father being pursued by a lion. Having a year of films that are all very different excites me, he says. I don't want people to be like, oh, this is an Idris Elba film, so I'm going to expect that. I feel very privileged to be considered an actor that has a lot of range. As if that weren't enough, you'll hear him as Knuckles, the blue guy's new adversary in Sonic the Hedgehog 2, out in April. Sonic was an opportunity Elba couldn't pass up because the self-proclaimed gamer grew up on that type of entertainment. I got weak in the knees, literally, he says of the offer, adding that it also earns him bonus points with his 7-year-old son. He's just coming into his own and likes to hear his old man in some of these animations. I love that. But even in cartoon form, the actor can't escape one of his signature traits, it seems. When the first trailer revealed his character, headlines proclaimed that Knuckles was now officially sexy, thanks to Elba's baritone. I don't know, man. It's really hard for me, because when I listen to my voice, I don't hear that, he says with a chuckle. I just hear my accent, or my soft R's, whatever imperfections I've got in my voice. That voice is also paving the way to a second career, with Elba DJing and collaborating with the likes of Macklemore and Ryan Lewis and Australian indie pop group Lime Cordial. Much more than a quirky side hobby, music is a passion. He performed at Coachella in 2019 that Elba hopes a wider audience will take as seriously as they do his on-screen work. Some may think, well, it will be the death of your acting if your music's shit, he says. I've dealt with the internal struggle of that over the years, so now I'm at peace, and I've chosen. This is what I'm doing, and I'm going to do it. Some will love it, and some will hate it. That slurry of confidence, passion, and embrace of the unknown feels like leading man energy, however much he plans to lean away from the acting work over the coming years to focus more on music. The thing about making music is it's a very consuming process, he says. It's very difficult to shoot a movie and then go off into the studio or make a song. It's like trying to build a souffle while making a brick wall. He's also directing more attention toward his production company, Green Door Pictures, which he founded in 2013. He admits that it got off to a slow start, but the past few years have seen a fresh wave of momentum, including a first look deal with Apple. It's part of his ongoing mission to support new talent, opening the door for those who may need Idris Elba to get them past the bouncers of Hollywood. David Canfield writes on Benedict Cumberbatch. Star turns in very different cinematic universes have let the sublime British actor study Hollywood up close. Benedict Cumberbatch doesn't dodge tough questions. In fact, he raises some of the thorniest ones himself. Over a long outdoor breakfast at the Malibu Racquet Club, we're preparing to discuss 2 of the most significant films of his career, Spider-Man, No Way Home, and The Power of the Dog, both of which came out this past year. Cumberbatch considers their heft. Am I working for the Goliath that's killing the David? He says. Technically, it's 2 Goliaths, Marvel and Netflix, respectively, but these days the Davids can't afford to be adversarial. Cumberbatch knows how difficult it is to get a movie made without a particular star power. Unless you have a Marvel star, financing any film is very, 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 very difficult, no matter how important the story, no matter how urgent the story, no matter how talented and awarded and appreciated the artist is. The director of The Power of the Dog, Jane Campion, recently said, "I actually hate superhero movies." Cumberbatch finds both challenging and has been balancing blockbusters and prestige projects with uncommon ease. Artistically, I never think of the two as completely mutually exclusive. He's everywhere he needs to be. In December, Cumberbatch's irascible, magic-wielding Doctor Strange helped resuscitate the box office, for IP-driven blockbusters anyway, by uniting Spider-Men of different universes for a record-shattering spectacle. This May, the Doctor gets his own sequel with Sam Raimi's Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. This likely sounds like a lot of special effects for a classically trained British actor, but Cumberbatch welcomes the challenge. "It's a big moment for Strange," he says. "We can bring our game to this large tentpole fair and give it an authenticity and a heartbeat and something that makes it not just effects-laden nonsense." Cumberbatch came to prominence in the title role of the BBC series Sherlock, which sparked a rabid online following when it debuted in 2010. He had, and has, an intense presence that's all the more riveting for being slightly odd and hard to quantify. What's going on in the heads of his haunted characters? Well, clearly a lot. And Cumberbatch reveals who these people are with slow, mesmerizing care. In The Power of the Dog, he plays Phil Burbank, a closeted rancher in 20s Montana whose cruel streak deepens dramatically when his brother marries a widow and she brings her quiet, protective son, played by Cody Smit McPhee, to live with them. The fact that Cumberbatch has played gay men in more than one highly decorated film role, another being his Oscar-nominated turn as Alan Turing in The Imitation Game, has provoked debate around sexuality and representation. While my lived experience is very far from Phil Burbank's, that's not to say that all of it is, he says carefully, but that's where we get into the realm of my privacy. Cumberbatch is married to the theater director Sophie Hunter. They have three children. After a pause, he continues, "I don't want to sound defensive, because I'm not. This is coming from a cultural questioning of appropriation, and that's something I'm very supportive of as a producer and an actor." He ruminates more on the topic, talking about fraught subjects with empathy and nuance. "If your community's underrepresented, then that's why people will be rightfully angry," he says. "I understand it. I do understand it. Maybe I'm entering a new era where I have to be much more sensitive about it." It's surely a heartening sign that a drama as character-driven and intimate as The Power of the Dog was distributed by a Goliath like Netflix. But Cumberbatch does have one misgiving. As he puts it, "If I'm in the belly of the beast, then surely I can start asking questions of it." The key question is this: why did Netflix give the film such a perfunctory run in theaters? Back in September, the drama screened exclusively at festivals around the world. Cumberbatch traveled with it and was bedridden with COVID in London after attending a crowd gathering, which he calls a sober reminder of limits. The gripping Western had only been playing in select theaters for 2 weeks before it hit the streamer. This is for Scott Stuber and Ted Sarandos and everyone who runs Netflix. "Could you not afford to have a longer theatrical release?" Cumberbatch asked now. "Maybe not. I don't know. I'm positioning this as a question publicly in Vanity Fair. I haven't actually had this conversation with them. But I would, and I will. So goes the journey of an actor in an industry transforming by the day." Next photos are of Penelope Cruz and Andrew Garfield. Now this from David Canfield. Penelope Cruz, the global superstar and Oscar winner, dug deep for her role in Parallel Mothers, her eighth project with longtime collaborator Pedro Almodovar. Winding down after a long cover shoot, Penelope Cruz sits back like she's got it all figured out. She's returned to the hair and makeup chair to deglam, her In-N-Out cheeseburger sitting patiently on the nearby counter. Colleagues pop in to hug her and say their goodbyes. She'll soon return home to Madrid, having spent the holidays here in Los Angeles with family. This is how Cruz prefers things. She doesn't allow her life or persona to be dictated by her industry. Only you can stop yourself from doing normal things, she says. Cruz gives every ounce of herself to her craft and very little to the attention that surrounds it. Since signing with an agent at 15, her work ethic has carried her through glitzy awards campaigns, tabloid romances, most notably with Tom Cruise, and endless intercontinental flights. After launching her career in her native Spain, Cruz would shoot several films a year. By the time she was 30, she'd amassed well over 30 feature credits. She's since turned more selective. Traveling nonstop, there was a point where I felt, okay, I'm taking care of all these characters, but what about my own story? And is now the kind of global star that remains exceedingly rare. Her 2022 credits range from the American spy thriller The 355 to the Spanish comedy Official Competition, which co-stars Antonio Banderas. She's our only Oscar-winning Spanish-born female actor. She's also acted in Italian, French, and English. It's a big part of our work to be able to transform into something that doesn't speak like you, doesn't move like you, she says. The fear is part of the appeal. I need that to function. I don't want to feel too safe. While Cruz, a mother of two, has managed a balanced life outside of Hollywood fame, her acting still takes a lot out of her. Consider the final month of filming Asghar Farhadi's kidnapping drama Everybody Knows, 2018, co-starring her husband Javier Bardem. Each night, Cruz inexplicably ran a fever. I know it was from the tension of that character. Or take shoots for her recent film Parallel Mothers. As a new parent, harboring a shocking secret, Cruz cried often, internalizing her character's pain. At one point, Cruz's own mother expressed concern about her mental state. I told her, don't worry. But I was worried, Cruz says now. I pretended that I had things under control, but I was scared. Her mother still checks in regularly, nearly a year after filming finished. The complications of mothers and motherhood is something of a recurring theme for Cruz and her greatest collaborator, the director Pedro Almodovar. Parallel Mothers marks their eighth project across four decades, and they consider each other family. We're not the same people that we were 30 years ago. We grew and experienced life together, Cruz says. She draws on a well of resources for her films. Years before, she played a version of Almodovar's mother in 2019's Pain and Glory, Cruz met and cried with his actual mother. For their latest project, she and Almodovar repeatedly ran through the script for nearly 5 months of rehearsal, resulting in a daring, wrenching performance. Cruz would do it all again in a second. As I sit with Cruz now, though, she's calm, collected, centered. She doesn't show how deep the work ran, nor that awards buzz has been loudly trailing her for months, and for the first time in years. A lot has changed since Cruz won the Supporting Actress Oscar for Vicky Cristina Barcelona in 2009. She was not yet a mother, and still something of an outsider to prestige Hollywood. She was entering a new phase of life and work. At that Oscar ceremony, five former winners, including Eva Marie Saint and Goldie Hawn, jointly presented Cruz with the trophy, a grand induction into industry royalty. It really felt like a dream, Cruz says. If I see the clip, it's like seeing somebody else win. She barely remembers the evening, save for certain flashes. Spotting Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Martin Scorsese seating together at the Vanity Fair after party, and quietly walking away, I said, I can't handle that. Calling her father with the news, catching up with Almodovar. Then she points to the burger on the counter. Oh, yeah, I'm going to In-N-Out on the way to the party, she says with a smile. A small taste of Hollywood, just the way she likes it. And from Cassie DaCosta, Andrew Garfield, it's actually his talent that goes tick, tick, boom. Andrew Garfield is ready to talk about the admirable work of his older brother, a pulmonary specialist in London, about the awe-inspiring experience of seeing New Yorkers take to the streets in the wake of George Floyd's murder, about the pain of losing his mother, Lynn, to cancer in 2019, about feeling a compulsion to jump into the ocean at Fire Island while preparing to film Tick, Tick, Boom. The open water jolted him. It was like I got the full download, Garfield says. It reminded me that sons and daughters have been losing their mothers since the dawn of time, and I had this very unique feeling of loss and grief. I just jumped into the club of losing the illusion that the person that gives you life is always going to be alive. Tick, Tick, Boom turned out to be the right project for this consciousness-expanding moment, playing the real-life theater composer Jonathan Larson, who died suddenly before he could see the wild success of his musical Rent, helped Garfield navigate the collective nature of loss. In conversation, the California-born, England-raised actor is warm and effusive, speaking in meandering but coherent paragraphs. He's also an astrology-dabbling part-time L.A. resident, Leo Sun, Pisces Rising, Aquarius Moon, if you must know. When discussing acting, he speaks passionately about fate and spontaneity. For him, it is not the result of some calculated process, but the expression of insuppressible instinct. Garfield gave a remarkable string of performances in 2021, playing an alluring L.A. grifter in Gia Coppola's Mainstream, scammy televangelist Jim Baker in Michael Showalter's The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and, of course, Larson. They reestablished him as an unabashed man of the heart, or more colloquially, as I suggest to him, a theater kid. Is it that obvious? Garfield replies. Is that clear? I'm proud. I wear that badge proudly. Theater saved my life. To be honest, I was an athlete and I was a clown. I was an idiot. But until I was 16, I didn't know theater was a thing. And then, yeah, I fell hard and fast, and there was no going back. In 2021, Garfield made a return of a different sort, playing Spider-Man once more in the enormous hit Spider-Man: No Way Home, a multiverse twist in the live-action franchise starring Tom Holland. Before the film premiered, Garfield had to lie about his part in it to the press, over and over, for at least 6 months. Was that a problem for someone driven by honesty and authenticity? Well, no. I loved keeping it secret. I was able to get over my ethical moral dilemma with whether this is a lie that is justifiable. Is this actually a lie, or is this just a fun gift I'm giving to people? Garfield's lifelong affinity for the story of Peter Parker, a working-class kid trying to protect the many from the greed of a few, made his return cathartic. Doing it alongside Tobey Maguire, who also reprised the role, was particularly poignant because Garfield had loved Maguire's Spider-Man movies. I was just obsessed with what he was doing. He suggested to Maguire and the filmmakers that the film feed off that energy. I have a full heart there, where I want Toby to be impressed by me, he told Vanity Fair. I want him to be my older brother, mentor figure, and to tell me I'm doing a good job. I want to compete with him. I want to better him. I want to rib him, have fun with him. Still, being an artist is not just about warm, filial feelings. The craft also requires sacrifice. Garfield illustrates that with a visceral anecdote. In 2018, after a two-show day performing the wrenching play Angels in America on Broadway, a part for which he won a Tony, Garfield arrived home exhausted, wanting only to devour a huge steak and watch the NBA playoffs. He bit into his meal, then began to choke. There were three levels of consciousness going on, he says, illuminating each with a different facial expression, his typically mellifluous register descending into hushed tones before rising into exclamation. One was, I want to enjoy my steak. I deserve my steak and my basketball. F this. The second level was, holy F, I think I might be in danger of actually asphyxiating myself here. And the third, be aware of your behavior, what you're doing, how you're feeling, the heat through your body. Remember the smells. Remember where you are. Because you're going to maybe have to choke on screen or on stage at some point. It was that level of insanity of, if you survive this, you can use it in a performance. Next photographs are of Michaela J. Rodriguez and Simu Liu. Chris Murphy writes on Michaela J. Rodriguez, the star on Growing Up in Newark, Making History in Hollywood, and Ignoring the Noise. I'm just a regular schmegular girl, says Michaela J. Rodriguez. Her pedigree would beg to differ. In 2021, Rodriguez became the first trans woman to earn an Emmy nomination in a leading acting category for her work as Blanca on the groundbreaking FX series Pose. In 2022, she added another pivotal win, the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Drama Series, making her the first transgender star to be so recognized by the HFPA. Child, it changed my whole perspective of how I saw myself and how I saw myself as an actress, Rodriguez says over Zoom, a day after finding out she won the Globe. I just felt so seen. Behind the awards and accolades hails a woman from Brick City, Newark, New Jersey, for the uninitiated, who burst with love for her hometown. There was a sense of culture, Rodriguez recalls. There was a sense of familia. There was a sense of understanding. Newark is predominantly African American, heavily Portuguese area, just a marginalized area in general. There was beauty in that. That's not to say Newark didn't have rough patches. Rodriguez had her run-ins with derogatory things as a child, who knew she was queer early on. The grass is not always green, she says, looking back. It definitely can be a little sandy yellow sometimes. In Newark, I would say the grass was not completely yellow or bronze. It was lime green, which is still cute. She weathered those lime green patches with her quick wit, talent, and strong sense of self. I was rambunctious, rebellious, she says. I was a chick that just did not care what people thought about me or said about me. My mouth at a very young age was quite sharp. It got me in and out of a lot of things. Soon it carried her all the way from Newark's Arts High School to Berklee College of Music, where she dreamed of becoming an R&B star. But Rodriguez left Berklee after 1 year to star as Angel in an off-Broadway production of Rent. It's been obviously reported that playing Angel helped her come to terms with her gender identity, but Rodriguez would like to set the record straight about that. When I was playing Angel, that was not the first time I actually discovered my gender identity, she says. I was 7 years old when I had an affirmation of myself. When I started Rent, I started medically transitioning, but I already had a self-assuredness of my femininity and womanhood when I was 7 years old. As the fierce mother of Pose's House of Evangelista, Rodriguez tapped into that self-assuredness and femininity. When it was announced that Ryan Murphy's drama would not return for a fourth season, Rodriguez was at peace with it. I feel like it ended at the right time, she says. I feel like we crossed the T's and dotted our I's, and we explained the experience of black trans women to the best of our ability, and now it lives on television forever. And while Pose has come to an end, Rodriguez's career is ramping up. She's released her first single, Something to Say, a summery Janet Jackson-esque bop, and promises that her first EP will arrive this year. She's landed the role of Sophia, a hard-working nonprofit director in Maya Rudolph's hotly anticipated untitled Apple TV Plus comedy, and recently appeared as Carolyn, a waitress and Jonathan Larson pal in Netflix's Tick, Tick, Boom. About a month before that film hit Netflix, Dave Chappelle stoked controversy on the same platform by telling transphobic jokes in his stand-up special Dave Chappelle, The Closer. Rodriguez was unfazed. "Listen," she says very deliberately, "I'm a girl from Brick City. I'm a girl from Newark, New Jersey. Is this on the record?" "It is, yes. I've had a lot of things that came my way. There was nothing that stopped me, slurs or whatever opinion somebody had about how I lived. It had nothing to do with me. It was always with them." So when the Chappelle special was released, I had nothing to say to it because I didn't watch it. Also, I had to keep pumping for my girls. I couldn't let someone's opinion or their thought process or even their comedy about the trans community deter me. Because the moment I let that happen, they win. The girls are going to keep pumping no matter what. "I still have not watched it to this day," Rodriguez says. "But," she adds with a smile, "I've been busy." Delia Kai writes on Simu Liu, "With Marvel's Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, the actor shouldered superhuman expectations with aplomb. Now he contends with the responsibilities and revelations of being a star." There's a charming pugilist persistence to the way Simu Liu parries any question into an excuse to say something nice about his co-workers. He tells me Philippa Su, his co-star in the upcoming rom-com One True Loves, has one of the best voices I've ever heard. Working with Saturday Night Live writer Celeste Yim was extremely rewarding. Randall Park, he insists, is an absolutely wonderful human being. Even the four-legged background actors in the forthcoming Arthur the King get a rave review. Lou adopted one of the dogs on set, but he's quick to add that all the dogs we worked with had such an amazing demeanor. "It's that stereotypical Canadian niceness, but polished to a mirror shine, per the accumulated media training of a Marvel Cinematic Universe member and newly designated Hollywood trailblazer who's wised up to the spotlight." While the world awaits the Shang-Chi sequel, Liu's plan is to double down on playing the everyman, something he says he admires about fellow MCUer Chris Pratt's trajectory. His other career crush, Michael B. Jordan, "Obviously, I don't have his face or pectorals, but I think he's a great guiding North Star," Liu says, of Jordan's business acumen. For One True Loves, Liu's excitement stems from the finer emotional work deployed to play a convincing soulmate. Meanwhile, Arthur the King will tackle familiar action terrain, though crucially of the non-martial arts variety, and the actor wisely shot it soon after his massive hit. "I was like, if I don't have something ready to go, it's going to be Simu is Shang-Chi and that's it," Liu says. But you can't talk about Liu's career without Shang-Chi, which single-handedly proved the Marvel Universe's staying power post-Avengers with a $432 million box office haul. And you can't talk about Shang-Chi without Liu's accompanying role as pop culture's representative du jour of the Asian diaspora. Had he always understood the weight of all the de facto advocacy required of a Hollywood first? Luckily, Liu's work on Kim's Convenience served as a good preview. "We were already being bombarded with those questions from day one. What does it mean to represent your people? Why is diversity important?" he sighs. "Initially, it felt uncomfortable, like we were asked to speak on these broad issues that were outside of our scope. I was a failed accountant from business school who, before I got the Kim's gig, was handing out dog food samples on the side of the street. I was not an Asian studies major. Nothing prepared me. What helped? Working on other projects, like Blood and Water, Fresh Off the Boat, and Aquafina is Nora from Queens, and being welcomed into the Asian American industry fold. When I first got to L.A., one of the first people who reached out to me was Ken Jeong, Lou tells me. He'd connected on Twitter with the actor who was shooting the ABC sitcom Dr. Ken at the time. He said, "Look, I'm going to give you a drive-on pass to the studio lot. You come whenever you want." And I took him up on it. I would go to tapings, and Ken, without fail, would bring me into his dressing room and ask me how I was doing. Lou pauses. "That was the first time I really felt the generosity of a community. I'll never forget that kind of kindness." The dilemma, then, after becoming one of the industry's most visible Asian faces, is what follows. The pressure to meet the expectations of an entire demographic, and the inevitable feeding frenzy that kicks up when you fall short. This is what weighs on Lou, who'll be publishing his memoir, We Were Dreamers, an immigrant superhero origin story, this May. The responsibility of representation in the era of niche internet vitriol, cancellation, and even, amazingly, flack for being annoying for doing too much. What I wasn't prepared for was backlash from within, for people to say, "He's not our representative," Lou says. Even if there are only a couple of people saying it, it always hurts. If Lou could rewind to 2019, right when he was preparing to take on the Shang-Chi mantle, he'd tell himself to loosen up more, to straighten up out of a heavily self-imposed defensive crouch. "I still feel very much like I'm an outsider in Hollywood, but I'm starting to realize I don't have to prove to anyone or myself that I deserve to be here," he concludes. "Taking up this space and being unapologetic, these things came a lot easier to me back in the day when I didn't have a seat at the table. I was playing a very different game, but I think I'm slowly finding that courage again." Son of a Preacher Man, by Gabriel Sherman. Jerry Falwell Jr. was the Trump-anointing dark prince of the Christian right, but after a sex scandal rocked his marriage and ended his lucrative stewardship of Liberty University, he's ready to admit he never had much use for his father's church anyway. Opening photo, prodigal son. Jerry Falwell Jr. and Becky Falwell, with their dogs Chance and Sandy in a 1941 Ford coupe they bought last year from rocker Jerry Lee Lewis. On the morning of August 18, 2021, Liberty University's freshman class began arriving on campus in Lynchburg, Virginia, for the start of Welcome Week. The kickoff to the fall semester had the exuberance of a pregame pep rally. An outdoor sound system blasted Gary Glitter's glam rock anthem, Rock and Roll Part 2. Student greeters in Navy Liberty t-shirts whooped and cheered when a new arrival's car pulled up to the dorms. Buildings all over the Jeffersonian-style campus were festooned with banners that read, Liberty University, 50 years of training champions for Christ. For 49 of those years, a member of the Falwell family had run Liberty, the country's most influential evangelical university. But the day before orientation started, Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of the late televangelist Jerry Falwell Sr., and the school's president and chancellor from 2007 to 2020, was nowhere near campus. He was driving a white Jeep Wrangler along a dirt road on his 500-acre farm about 20 miles west of Lynchburg. That's the tallest mountain in Virginia, he said, pointing at the Appalachian peaks rising in the distance. Ahead of us, Black Angus cattle grazed in fenced pastures. At the edge of the property stood a 19th-century chapel no larger than a one-room schoolhouse. Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant both worshipped in that church on different days, Falwell said in his laconic drawl. It was the first time I met Falwell in person. Behind the wheel, the 59-year-old looked like a prosperous country lawyer turned gentleman farmer. He was dressed in a lavender polo, dark jeans, and chestnut-brown leather sneakers. He had neatly parted silver hair and a trim silver beard on his round face. His wolf-like ice-blue eyes were the only visible signs of the feral personality that had recently cost him his job and reputation. On August 24, 2020, Falwell resigned from Liberty in the wake of a sensational tabloid scandal that could have been dreamed up in the writer's room of the Righteous Gemstones. A former Miami pool boy named Giancarlo Granda claimed he had a nearly 7-year affair with Falwell's wife, Becky, and that Falwell often liked to watch them have sex. Granda went on a national media tour. He gave interviews to ABC News, CNN, Reuters, Politico, and The Washington Post, and said the Falwells began grooming him when he was 20, and bought his silence with luxury vacations, rides on Liberty's private jet, and an ownership stake managing a Miami Beach hostel. To bolster his claims, Granda released screenshots of FaceTime calls and text conversations with Becky. "I'm not wearing any panties," she allegedly wrote Granda in one message. Falwell released a statement that acknowledged Becky and Granda's relationship, but he vehemently denied watching the tryst. Instead, Falwell said he was the real victim of a fatal attraction-type extortion plot after Granda demanded $2 million to keep the affair secret. Viewed in hindsight, the scandal was the combustion of a self-immolating fire that Falwell had been stoking for months, if not years. Liberty had spent the better part of 2020 lurching from one PR crisis to the next, brought on by Falwell's boorish and reckless behavior, his race-baiting, COVID-19 denials, and slavish devotion to Donald Trump. 2 days after George Floyd's murder in May 2020, Falwell tweeted a picture of a COVID mask that showed a man in blackface posing with a man in a KKK hood. In early August 2020, Falwell posted a photo on Instagram of himself aboard a yacht with his pants unzipped, a drink in one hand, and his other arm wrapped around a pregnant Liberty employee with her belly exposed. The controversies turned Falwell into an avatar of the rank hypocrisy, know-nothingism, and toxic masculinity that explained why 81% of white evangelical Christians voted in 2016 for Trump. A thrice-married reality TV star who literally boasted of grabbing women by the pussy. The day Falwell resigned from Liberty, he gave an interview to his local NPR station and invoked the peroration of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty I'm free at last," Falwell said. He offered no other explanation for his spectacular meltdown. People inside and outside Liberty were left asking what had caused Falwell, a married father of three, to completely self-destruct in public. He was a University of Virginia-trained lawyer and successful real estate developer. He rescued Liberty from near bankruptcy and transformed the nonprofit university into a financial powerhouse with more than 100,000 students and a $1.7 billion endowment. Over the course of a few months, he blew it all up. Why? I had gone to the farm to find out. After giving me the tour, Falwell parked in front of a handsome farmhouse. Becky was waiting at the front door in jeans, sandals, and a black T-shirt that matched her long raven hair. She apologized about the exercise bike sitting incongruously in the foyer. "I started riding it, but it killed my butt because the seat is slanted," she said as we entered. "I don't know what we're going to do with it," Falwell complained. Becky told him to drag it to the garage and disappeared down the hall. I found her on the patio, checking on their golden retriever, Sandy, who was patiently nursing a litter of four-week-old puppies. The father, a shaggy 8-year-old named Chance, dozed on the floor. "He's an old, lazy man," Becky said. A short while later, the Falwells sat in the kitchen and began to talk about the tumultuous events of the past 2 years. The wide-ranging conversation was one of many we had over the past 8 months. What emerged was an intimate look inside a very public marriage, as well as a Shakespearean drama about fathers and sons and the burden of legacy. For the first time, Falwell opened up about his true spiritual beliefs and how they diverge from those of his infamous father, who co-founded the Moral Majority and waged a scorched-earth cultural war for 4 decades. When I told Falwell that many people thought he, consciously or not, wanted to destroy himself, he considered it for a moment. "Subconsciously, yeah, I believe that's true," he said, nodding. "It's almost like I didn't have a choice." He went on, "Because of my last name, people think I'm a religious person, but I'm not. My goal was to make them realize I was not my dad." When you think of Jerry Falwell Sr., chances are you remember him as the Falstaffian televangelist who never refused an opportunity to say something outrageously offensive on camera. Falwell's back catalog of homophobic, racist, and misogynistic comments is as thick as the King James Bible. In a 1958 sermon, Falwell inveighed against the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision that, on paper, integrated public schools. "The facilities should be separate. When God has drawn a line of distinction, we should not attempt to cross that line," Falwell said. During a 1976 service, Falwell preached, "The idea that religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to prevent Christians from running their own country." In the mid-1990s, Falwell promoted the Clinton Chronicles, $43, a right-wing propaganda video that accused the Clintons of a raft of crimes, up to and including murder. And days after 9/11, Falwell went on television and blamed the terrorist attacks on gays, lesbians, feminists, abortion doctors, and the ACLU. "I point the finger in their faces and say, 'You helped this happen,'" Falwell said. Well, Jerry Falwell Sr. was a polarizing scold in public, an agent of intolerance, John McCain once said. Jerry Jr. remembered his father as lenient at home. "My dad wasn't one of those overbearing parents who tried to control their kids," he recalled. The elder Falwell didn't force his namesake to attend church, and didn't care that his son collected Fleetwood Mac and Beatles records at a time when Baptists called rock and roll devil's music. He also didn't object when Jerry declared at an early age that he didn't want to spread the good word. "People would say to me, 'We know you're going to be a preacher because your dad is one.' I thought, 'That's the last thing I want to be,'" Jerry said. He even tolerated Jerry's moderate drinking, despite preaching that alcohol was the worst, most offensive drug in American society. I asked him one time, "Why don't you drink? Jesus drank wine," Jerry remembered, and he said, "Well, I just like to be in control. I don't like to be drunk." It wasn't because of some religious reason. His father's contradictions would mold Jerry's entire life. Jerry Falwell Jr. was born in Lynchburg on Father's Day, 1962. He was the oldest of three children. His sister, Jeannie, was born in 1964. His brother, Jonathan, arrived in 1966. As patriarch, Falwell Sr. was the sun around which the family orbited. Naturally, his sons competed for his affection. It wasn't Cain and Abel exactly, but the brothers' relationship was never close. "Jonathan was just constantly copying me. Whatever I did, in a matter of time, he tried to duplicate it," Jerry told me. Jonathan Falwell declined to comment. It also didn't help that the brothers' personalities were so different. Jerry was the withdrawn, rebellious one. Jonathan, the gregarious rule follower. "The brothers just looked at each other as weird," a family friend said. It's ironic that Falwell Sr. was closest with his least outwardly religious son. "My dad and I were thick as thieves. He didn't see eye to eye with Jonathan," Jerry said. Temperamentally, the two Jerrys clicked. They loved playing jackass-style pranks on people. One time, Jerry Sr. put a live baby alligator in his wife Maisel's bathtub. "She nearly fainted when she found it," recalled Mel White, Falwell Sr.'s ghostwriter. Jerry Jr. once threw roadkill into a friend's car as it went by, causing everyone inside to scream. His favorite song for a while was Loudon Wainwright's Dead Skunk. At Liberty, Falwell Sr. terrorized students by speeding his SUV through crowded crosswalks. Jerry worried his dad would eventually run someone over, so he purchased a train horn with a compressor for his dad's SUV. Falwell Sr. loved driving around campus, blaring the deafeningly loud whistle at unsuspecting students. Jerry's relationship with his mother was another matter. Maisel was a hardline Baptist and unsuccessfully pushed Jerry to adopt her rigid lifestyle. "I wasn't someone my mom could control," Jerry said. Jerry said Jonathan became his mother's favorite son. She realized Jonathan was someone she could control. Maisel was thrilled when Jonathan later became a pastor. By the 1970s, Jerry Falwell Sr. was a national celebrity due to the popularity of his television show, The Old Time Gospel Hour. Whereas Billy Graham preached a gospel of redemption, Falwell saw himself as a field marshal in a cosmic battle between God and Satan. Jerry, then a teenager, frequently traveled with his dad to the front lines of the culture war. "We'd fly around on these old DC-3s from city to city. It was like the movie Almost Famous," he recalled. "I'd be the kid in the back of the auditorium, selling my dad's books and records to people while he preached. I would have all this money stuffed into every pocket. That was my life." Looking back, Jerry said that his father's peripatetic lifestyle provided a reprieve from an oppressive marriage. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.